Welcome to Curious Campus, a discussion about science, discovery, and culture brought to you by the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. I'm your host, Howie Mack. Today, we have episode 3 of a 3-part series looking at childhood development. How did the COVID-19 pandemic affect the mental health of tweens, or children between the ages of 10 and 14? Did adolescents who experience loss, family strife, or social isolation suffer more from depression or substance use than those with fewer pandemic-related stresses? The ABCD Project is a sweeping nationwide research effort that's given researchers a chance to examine these questions and others. ABCD stands for Adolescent Brain Cognitive Development, and the project began in 2016. It is the largest long-term study of brain development and child health in the United States. ABCD is tracking how 12,000 young brains are developing and how life experiences affect that development. In 2020, surveys of these adolescents explored how their experiences during the pandemic might help explain how they could manage or not manage additional stress, and how all of this might change their brains. Our guests today are Krista Lisdahl, professor of psychology, and Ashley Stinson, a graduate student in psychology in UWM's College of Letters and Science. They join us today to discuss their involvement in the ABCD study and what it's told us so far. Krista, Ashley, welcome to Curious Campus.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, thanks for having us.
So, Krista, I'd like to direct these first several questions to you. The ABCD project was already well underway when the pandemic hit. So before we dive into pandemic-related specifics, could you provide our listeners some general background on the study?
Yeah, sure. So UWM is actually one of 21 different research sites across the country that's collecting lots of data from children and their parents. There's actually 386 families in this region in southeastern Wisconsin. And this is a big science project funded by the National Institute of Health. The pool of participants right now is actually about 12,000 families that we're following for 10 years. So we're trying to really generate detailed data about how young brains, you know, develop and mature and what childhood experiences really, you know, put people on different trajectories. So we look into complex things, you know, related to family, peer, sociocultural factors, neighborhood factors, as well as, you know, physical health and individual neurobiology. So we really want to understand these complex risk and resilience factors that are going to influence brain development over time with the ultimate goal of really optimizing adolescent health.
Okay. So you mentioned that there are a lot of families involved in this, and I imagine that being the case, you're going to find a lot of variation, and there's going to be a lot of moving parts overall as well. So what can you tell us about the project's scope of research and how you're going about gathering data to support that?
Yeah, well, the scope is quite huge. We would call this, you know, big data. It's the real state of the science to harmonize these research projects across multiple sites with really hundreds of scientists contributed, as well as, these community relationships and the ABCD. The families that are enrolled in ABCD are such important partners in that. So we're looking at, you know, complex relationships between genetics, neurocognition, and brain structure. What does their neighborhood look like, as well as their physical health? And in the last couple of years, we've definitely been interested too in how the pandemic and COVID-19 related factors might be influencing that development.
So are you just giving them surveys and connecting with them that way? Are you, having diagnostic testing as well? What are the basics on that?
They undergo, behavioral testing, like personality testing, cognitive testing, very advanced brain imaging. They provide biological samples where we can measure their genetics as well as their physical health, like their immune functioning, kind of lab blood levels, things like that. And we get geocoded data that tells them about the neighborhood that they're living in. You know, what about their neighborhood safety or their resources, school quality, even things like access to green space so they can get out there and do lots of physical activity, as well as, nice interviews with parents and the kids about their own peer relationships and family relationships. So it's pretty extensive.
I was going to say, it sounds like you're really hitting a broad swath of information. And I'm assuming the data is probably unlike anything you've ever received before.
It's definitely a huge step in the right direction to really, you know, we were talking earlier before the show that we're parents and we, you know, you really understand that development is so complex and there's so many things that can affect it. So really coming together in this team science and working out in the community to see what matters to parents, you know, what do pediatricians want to know? What does, you know, school administrators and teachers want to know? What do the teens themselves want to know? And so when we really talk to everyone, it expands out into this complexity, mm-hmm. because it's not just your biology, it's how you're interacting with your world. And, you know, if the COVID-19 pandemic has taught us anyway, we're not all in the same boat. And we really have to consider these social and kind of neighborhood and environmental factors too.
Sure. And it takes on doubly importance when you are a parent. I mean, I'm a parent of a 13-year-old and an 11-year-old, and I know you're a parent mm-hmm. as well. And when the pandemic hit, yes, we're all worried about our individual safety, but you know, at the end of the day, we're worried about our kids' safety as well, right? And yeah. So, you know, you're in the midst of the study prior to the pandemic, and you're just learning all of these things. The pandemic comes along, and it really put the study's project members in a unique position to research how the pandemic disruptions affected the participants in the study. So, what did you explore when this comes along?
Yeah. Well, you know, before we even get into that, I just want to acknowledge, you know, how hard the last 2 years have been on families, you know, throughout the world and in Wisconsin. And just want to thank the ABCD families for sticking with us, and as well as the staff. You know, they worked so hard to continue to collect data and to continue to engage with us so we could really understand how it affected adolescent health. But, you know, we're not only thinking about, you know, the infection itself, which has its own impact on health, but the sociocultural, you know, impact of the pandemic, how it affected families, how it affected their engagement at school, and how that might be affecting their mental health.
What did you find after you looked at these data points?
Yeah, so we had a collaborative team that Ashley Stinson was part of, kind of a COVID-19 sub-study. And one of the first studies we looked at was with Dr. Will Pelham and Sandy Brown at UCSD. And they were looking at substance use patterns, you know, before the pandemic and after, kind of controlling for age. Were the teenagers kind of starting to use drugs and alcohol more often or maybe less? And we actually saw overall substance use was pretty stable about 6 months into the stay-at-home orders, like really those first several months of the pandemic back in 2020. We did find some individual things, like actually alcohol use decreased and nicotine use and prescription drug use slightly increased. And this is especially true when there was a lot of, you know, stress in the household or family, you know, facing a lot of material hardship or a lot of drug and alcohol use by the parents.
Okay. How did social distancing impact these findings?
Yeah, we actually looked at, you know, some of these things really specifically related to avoiding COVID infection, like social distancing or worry about COVID. Those didn't seem to really be linked with substance use. It was more like these family factors in the household.
Yeah. All right. So I know as a parent, I dove into as much data as I could to try to figure out how best to help my children through this. And I'm certain that I'm not alone along those lines. I'm guessing you did the same thing as well, and a lot of our listeners did as well. So I'm going to ask you a very specific question about the takeaways from these studies, and more to the point, how they provide clues of how parents might help children better weather the storm.
Yeah. So across a few of the studies, what we found was that there really were some hints towards resilience. So, for example, one of the studies looked at how socioeconomic, like, disadvantagement in the household and in the neighborhood might be linked with, you know, mental health or disease burden. And they did find that, you know, households with lower economic status did have increased COVID-19 disease burden, but they also had more family communication. And in fact, those parent-youth conversations about COVID-19 and really the importance of, you know, why are we wearing masks? Why are we social distancing? You know, why is school disrupted? And giving them a lot of reassurance seemed to be very protective for those youth's mental health, as well as, you know, increasing or affecting some preventative behaviors. So that was really a lesson in kind of resilience, that it's worth really talking with your teenagers about the why and maybe even orienting that more towards the collective good. You know, why are we doing this for our neighborhood? Why are we doing this for our family? Some other things that I was really looking for as a mom of, you know, a teenager in middle school going through the pandemic was, what else could I do? What else could other parents do? And we do see across a few studies that parental monitoring, so kind of knowing where your kids are, and also if they're doing at-home schooling or any sort of hybrid schooling, really checking in with them a lot about their school, talking about how school is going. And the data actually shows that the parents that did that, their kids felt a lot better about, you know, remote learning, and they felt a lot more school satisfaction. So that parent monitoring, open communication about the whys, you know, really having them be partners, like not trying, you know, because I think a lot of times us parents, we try and protect them from bad things happening. But, you know, the truth is we can't stop bad things from happening. All we can really do is teach them how to cope and teach them how to work through those emotions and provide that support. So really checking in with them. And then some other things that we see are, you know, increased physical activity, getting outside especially, using kind of screen time in the way that it's social connectiveness, so like playing video games together, maybe not so much on just straight up social media, though.
Okay.
Because that seemed to be more problematic. And then doing things like, so those are things at the family level, and I just have to say that there's only so much we can do at the family level. Like, there's societal level things that we also need to be doing, like increasing resources and access to healthcare, COVID-19 resources, making sure that, you know, teachers have a lot of resources so they can be doing more monitoring of the kids at home. You know, I had a lot of friends that absolutely couldn't be home, you know, during those times. And they were really relying on their neighborhood friends and family to try and check in. So trying to boost and support those services. And also another factor that came through was a lot of experience of discrimination and racism during the pandemic for multiple reasons, for some of it directly related to COVID-19, and that was really related to distress, especially in our teenagers of color. So again, you know, really working towards reducing discrimination and institutionalized racism in our education and healthcare systems.
So I know that you've got a personal connection to this work. You know, you mentioned that you're a parent, but I also know that your personal background had a real influence on the reasons you got involved in this type of work in the first place. So I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners a little bit more about that.
Yeah, of course. So, you know, as a middle schooler, I'd say I began to be curious about, really noticing friends and family struggling with substance use issues and starting to wonder, you know, what really put people on their various paths. When I went to college, I got more and more interested in almost the neurobiology of what happens with repeated drug exposures. And then over time, you know, you notice a lot of individual differences to those neurobiological consequences, and you really learn that neurobiology alone, you know, is just not going to tell you the full story. So over time, I've gotten a lot more interested in this interaction between, you know, family-peer relationships, social, cultural influences, and, you know, like environmental factors, like even access to, you know, nutritional food in your neighborhood or access to green spaces or exposure to environmental pollutants. So trying to take a larger view of almost more of a social neuroscience or environmental neuroscience picture now. And, you know, as a mom, the bottom line, you know, I passionately want to know, what are some evidence-based things that really optimize adolescent development? Like, this is the gateway into adulthood. And we see if we really invest during this period, childhood and adolescence, that we're going to have an impact for decades, you know, in someone's life versus intervening much later in their 40s, 50s, 60s when we're really, it's much harder to intervene later. So I really want to be helpful to all the parents and teenagers out there that just want to, you know, live the healthiest life that they can.
You're listening to Curious Campus, a discussion about science, discovery, and culture brought to you by the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. I'm your host, Howie Magner, and our guests today are Krista Lisdahl, professor of psychology, and Ashley Stinson, a graduate student in psychology, both of whom are in UWM's College of Letters and Science. I'd like to bring Ashley into the conversation because she's been sitting patiently over here while Chris and I have been having the conversation. And Ashley, kind of following up on what Chris had just said about you know, having a personal interest in this type of work, I know that you have a personal connection as well as to why you got involved in this work. And before we, you know, dive into your work about adolescent mental health during the pandemic, would you be willing to share with our listeners a little bit about your background and why you were drawn into this type of work as well?
Sure. And thanks again for having me. So, my background, you know, I grew up in Alabama and, you know, finished my undergraduate degree in psychology. I'm at the University of Alabama and actually moved to Milwaukee in 2019, right before the pandemic, to start my graduate degree here at UWM. Similar to Krista, I feel like I have a personal connection to substance use research. I feel like you'd be probably hard pressed to find someone who doesn't know someone who might have been impacted by substance use. For me, like, doing this type of research is really important because, I mean, you really have the opportunity to connect with communities and really use this data and the science to really inform policy, even on a larger scale of thinking about, like, again, like, larger impact for, like, social justice change. And again, addressing some of the societal factors that Krista mentioned that drive some of these outcomes.
And you were the lead study you were the lead author on a study exploring whether adolescents who experienced childhood adversity had more mental health difficulties during COVID than adolescents without those adversities. And as part of that study, you wanted to know if race made a difference. So could you dive into that a little bit more?
Sure, absolutely. So I guess just a little context about, like, childhood adversity. Kind of when I say that, I mean experiences that kiddos might have, the things like abuse, neglect, or other factors that might relate to, like, family dysfunction broadly. And so, like, our understanding of the literature, we know that individuals who experience childhood adversity are kind of set up on some trajectories that lead to negative health outcomes broadly. So when thinking about the pandemic, we were really interested in seeing if we could identify risk factors that might make a youth more vulnerable to the effects of the pandemic. So for us, we're really interested in seeing if childhood adversity might be one of those risk factors. So when looking at that, our main findings were that individuals or youth who had experienced childhood adversity actually had experienced poorer mental health broadly during the pandemic. However, there was some resilience where we saw that over the earlier months of the pandemic, youth actually showed some improvements in their mental health, which again, I think is really shows some strength in our cohort. But then related to, like, our kind of follow-up, we know that childhood adversity impacts communities differently. And we also know that the pandemic has impacted communities differently as well, particularly with minoritized racial and ethnic groups, particularly experiencing more of these negative outcomes. So because we, based on, like, what we know so far with research, we wanted to see if the relationship between childhood adversity and mental health during the pandemic was the same across youth from different racial or ethnic backgrounds. So when we explored that area, we actually saw that overall, regardless of raciness or ethnicity, youth with ACEs were experiencing poor outcomes. So the relationships weren't necessarily different just because of race, ethnicity. However, though, we did see that when looking at racial or ethnic backgrounds, specifically, we did see that youth from minoritized racial ethnic backgrounds did experience poor COVID mental health related factors. So, like, more worry about COVID or more stress, which I guess, kind of highlights again how like their communities have been more impacted by COVID, which likely explains why we found that difference.
Okay. And you touched on this a little bit, Ashley, but would you like to dive into a little bit more about what we already know about the impact of chronic early life or childhood adversities?
Sure. So I want to note that a lot of the childhood adversity literature focuses on assessing these things later in life, in adulthood. But yeah, we found that unfortunately individuals who experience this adversity typically have poor mental health outcomes or a greater risk for physical poor health outcomes as well. We've also seen alterations in brain structure and function, and also seen like differences in like the ability to for different cognitive abilities. So like the ability related to being able to process emotions or to be able to make decisions or inhibit responses. But yeah, some of the important work is that, you know, while we look at this later in life, it's really important also to look at childhood adversity while the children are actually experiencing it, since development is really important during adolescence. Looking at and during adulthood is not enough. So yeah, that's definitely the future directions for the research.
Is there anything else that we should know about chronic early life adversity and its impact down the road?
Sure. Yeah, I think the child adversity literature is really starting to think about not only like social outcomes, but also thinking about physiological and also like cognitive and brain outcomes that might be related to experiencing this adversity. So within the literature, there's been some studies that have shown that experiencing childhood adversity is related to some deficits in cognitive abilities, like motion, emotional processing, and also thinking about broadly executive functioning, which is ability and skill that's really related to really important skills like decision making, switching between tasks, and also planning for the future. And also thinking about brain outcomes. We really see changes in these regions and also how the brain functions in regions we identify with some of these cognitive abilities.
Right. And I mean, that makes complete sense, right? The earlier you can pick up on these things or the earlier you can identify issues, the sooner you can address it. And therefore, the kids theoretically would have a better chance of having a better outcome, right?
Absolutely. And you know, one of the things that we really try to do in ABCD is get findings out quickly. You know, even like this whole experience, Ashley's study that she took on, she analyzed and published, you know, within a year of the pandemic, which is very fast in science. And one thing I didn't mention earlier is that ABCD is an open science model, so we release all the data to the whole scientific community and create a lot of different collaborative teams. And so people are very motivated to get that, to get these findings out quickly and to start talking to policymakers. Like I know that Ashley's paper was included in the Surgeon General's report regarding the COVID-19 pandemic on adolescent mental health in real time. And so I know that the policymakers were looking at that research and considering it and recommending, you know, that ACEs be measured and tracked in schools and to maybe identify kids that are at higher need for mental health services and extra supports.
Ashley, that's got to be a very gratifying situation for you to know that the work that you've done has the potential to have such an impact so quickly.
Absolutely. I think with most researchers, they'd probably say that ultimately they hope their work, you know, does inform policy. So yeah, it was really great to see how in the Surgeon General's report that work was already being incorporated.
And the work continues, right, Krista? I know your research group has a new grant from the National Institutes of Health looking at physical outcomes of youth who contracted COVID. And I'm wondering if you can share with our listeners what you're hoping to do with that project.
Yeah, so again, this is a large collaborative team. And actually, this is the NIH Recover Project. So this is including multiple consortiums, both pediatric, which we're a part of, as well as adult. And the goal here is across multiple cohort studies to really understand specifically the effects of long COVID on physical and mental health as well. So for our study, in the ABCD study, what we're going to be doing is collecting a very small, very, very small blood sample, that just a little tiny pricket on your finger that you can actually do at home and then mail in. And this is going to measure whether or not the youth or the parent have antibodies to an infection, a prior infection from COVID-19. And then we can link that data with the rest of the ABCD data to really look at, you know, in youth that are experiencing any sort of long COVID symptoms. So, you know, ongoing respiratory problems, we're hearing lots of things about brain fatigue, physical fatigue, as well as, you know, breathing problems or even heart damage. So looking at those symptoms and really linking it pre-pandemic functioning to kind of post-pandemic functioning. We won't know exactly when they had their infection, so we can't dig in, you know, to that level of timing. But overall, we can look at, you know, are there brain changes over time in those kids that are experiencing long COVID symptoms? And the other consortiums will be doing, you know, really, much more in-depth research with CT scanning of lungs and extra medical batteries attached.
And I don't mean to put you on the spot, but having this knowledge now, how could it help, you know, these kids down the road?
Well, the main purpose is to really have a much more reliable measure of the symptom clusters associated with long COVID in young people. So we might know that a little bit better in adults, because adults are much more likely to end up in the hospital system. They're maybe more likely to be followed by their PCPs. What we're looking for is, you know, is there any kind of hidden long COVID symptoms in these kids that have been exposed that maybe we're not picking up or treating quick enough or treating aggressively enough? So, you know, the aim is to improve the healthcare and the support of any of those teenagers that are potentially, you know, having some of these long COVID symptoms.
So I imagine as all of this data becomes available, Krista, we'll learn a lot more about the virus in kids as well.
Yeah. So not only characterizing, you know, the effects of long COVID on physical health, but also looking into whether youth that are in neighborhoods that are underserved or more likely to have, you know, health disparities, whether they're experiencing, you know, different symptoms of it or not getting as much follow-up care. You know, can we identify, any sort of medical issues more reliably and really just improve care, especially for those neighborhoods that are potentially underserved. And so that might, you know, help us more quickly identify long COVID symptoms in kids. And, you know, the other part is really just identifying more complex risk and resilience factors that might improve long COVID outcomes in kids.
Well, Krista, Ashley, we've covered so much information here, and I suspect we could talk for another half hour and cover a lot more, but we only have so much time. So I'd like to thank you both for coming on the show and for sharing all of this information with our listeners. Continued best of luck with the research, and hopefully this helps a lot of people in what's a very difficult time.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
Yes, thank you so much.
And that's today's show. Thanks for listening. Our guests today were Krista Lisdahl, a professor of psychology at UWM, and Ashley Stinson, a graduate student in psychology at UWM. Curious Campus is produced by Gennaro Armas and Laura Otto. Our engineer is Jason Reavy, and I'm your host, Howie Magner. If you enjoyed our show, please consider subscribing on your favorite podcast app.